If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorn. Today, we've got a conversation about the Corn Laws with historian Stephen Bates, who recently wrote a piece on the Corn Laws for the May issue of BBC History Magazine. Our production editor, Spencer Mizzen, spoke to Stephen to find out more about why the 19th century legislation stirred up so much trouble, both in Parliament and on the streets.
Stephen, in your feature in our May issue, you described the Corn Law crisis as a huge political battle over the price of bread. Now, for those who don't know, what exactly were the Corn Laws and what did they set out to achieve?
Well, the Corn Laws were a protectionist measure for British farmers and landowners. There had been import tariffs on food before through the centuries, but the Corn Laws were specifically introduced in 1815, immediately after the end of the Napoleonic Wars, specifically to protect the prices that farmers were going to receive for their grain. And of course, that meant that imports from abroad, mainly from Europe at that stage, were very much restricted because they were so much more expensive than they would otherwise have been if they were competing directly with English agriculture. So it was a protectionist measure and, of course, very much favoured by farmers and landowners because it kept their prices high.
Now, and this was a particularly divisive issue, wasn't it, in the Tory party at the time. I mean, why were Tories in particular so exercised over this issue?
Well, they saw themselves not only as the patriotic party, as they always have, but also as the farmer's friend. And an awful lot of them, of course, were landowners and were also had an interest in agriculture. It wasn't entirely a conservative measure. There were a number of Whig, later Liberal MPs who were also opposed to reforming the Corn Laws. And there were also was also a faction amongst Tory MPs, perhaps the more progressive sort, and certainly eventually including Robert Peel, who thought that this imposition made food prices more expensive and were a block on trade and prosperity and were storing up trouble with the working class.
But before we go on, can you just paint a picture of what Britain was like at this moment in the second quarter of the 19th century? I mean, would you describe it as a country in turmoil?
It was certainly a country which wasn't particularly at ease with itself. It had undergone immense changes over the previous 50 years with the Industrial Revolution. People were leaving the land and moving towards better paid jobs in towns and cities. Industry was taking off and was becoming a force in the economy. A larger and larger proportion of the economy was dependent upon trade and industrial processes. And that was also a threat to the Corn Laws because owners and manufacturers and employers saw that corn and bread was being made artificially more expensive for their workers. It meant they had to pay larger wages as well, otherwise they wouldn't have any workers who could afford to man the factories that were springing up. So they were actually rather hostile to it. They bought into the free trade economic theory that was gaining ground at this time, the idea that you could trade freely across the world, and that would be advantageous for British industry, not least because Britain was at the forefront of the Industrial Revolution, the most prosperous country in the world.
Now, how exactly did opposition to the Corn Laws manifest itself in the wider country in the run-up to the Corn Law crisis?
Well, there have been a series of uprisings, rebellions, and episodes of discontent, I suppose you could say, throughout the 30-odd years since the end of the Napoleonic Wars. People were rebelling about the fact that food was expensive, and it was playing over into politics because they saw the remedy to high prices being to have a say in the politics of the country through its parliament. Of course, most of them didn't have the vote at all and so couldn't influence events. Many of the industrialists in the new industrial towns had the vote, but the cities and large towns didn't have any representation because the old political system pre-1832 was heavily biased towards the countryside and particularly towards the south of England, not the north and the Midlands.
So was this adopted as kind of a cause célèbre for those who wanted the franchise to be extended, like for example, the Chartists?
Yes, it was. And the repeal of the Corn Laws was central both to the Chartists and to a body called the Anti-Corn Law League, which was set up amongst the manufacturers, chiefly in Lancashire, specifically with the aim of abolishing the Corn Laws. They saw lots of advantages of the sort I've described, freeing up trade, improving international trade through a free trade system, and more precisely, easing the problems of their workers, the prices that they were having to pay for basic food commodities, and also with the ancillary purpose of enabling them to either employ more workers themselves or even to reduce wages because food was cheaper.
And to what extent did the Napoleonic Wars sort of trigger sort of disaffection with Britain's leaders among sort of the wider population?
It fed into a wider discontent. People thought that if you change the political system, then it will be more responsive to your needs, your problems. Get rid of the old guard of politics, elect new men from the industrial areas, and also maybe even eventually make them listen to the working classes. There was lots of talk in the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars of the need for a provisional government, which some of the working class thought meant a government that would provide them with provisions rather than a temporary government. And there were a series of uncoordinated uprisings in the years after the Napoleonic Wars. First of all, there was the Luddites who smashed up industrial machinery in an attempt to reverse the effects of the factory system and the Industrial Revolution. Later, there were the swing riots of the early 1830s in the rural southeast of England, people burning ricks and threatening farmers because of the high prices, because of the poverty and the starvation that many of them faced, certainly in years when there were bad harvests.
So I wonder if you just go into a little bit more detail on exactly how acute the impact of the Corn Laws was on the poorest residents of the British Isles.
Well, bread formed a large part of the diet of many people in Britain, and it, because the price of bread was high, it was also a large part of their wages had to go towards basic foodstuffs. You're talking unimaginably in these days of labourers and skilled workers earning between, well, 10 shillings, 50p in modern circumstances, to a pound a week, and bread costing maybe a shilling, maybe even a bit more than a shilling. So you can see it was a large part of the wage bill, a shilling being, of course, 5p in decimal currency. Obviously, it bought a lot more than 5p's worth would today, but still, it was a large proportion of the essential expenditure of working class households.
And am I right in saying this has felt most keenly in Ireland?
It was felt certainly in Ireland because the Irish economy was very vulnerable. In large parts of the south and the west of Ireland, potatoes have become the central crop, and people lived off what they could grow on their small holdings. And that meant that if the potato crop failed, starvation was essentially going to follow that. And indeed, it was going to follow it in other parts of the country as well, including Scotland. So the population, the peasant population of South and West Ireland was particularly vulnerable to a failure of the potato crop. It meant that they would have long stretches of the year where they had virtually no food.
How would you characterise pro-corn law Tories' attitude to the suffering of the Irish?
Tory landowners shared the general prejudice against Ireland and the Irish. They were regarded as an alien people. Indeed, some of them thought they were scarcely human at all. There'd been centuries of persecution of the Catholic peasantry in Ireland. And frankly, in days before easy mass communications like we have today, they started off in denial about the condition of the Irish, the starvation and the death that was occurring. And basically, and you can see this is a Tory trope through the generations, they thought they should pull their bootstraps up, get out to work and get themselves some money. And that was the way out of the situation. Feeding them, helping them survive the famine would only encourage them. And this was a very common attitude on the Tory benches in the 1840s.
Now, as you've alluded to, the figurehead of the opposition to the Corn Laws was the two-time Prime Minister Robert Peel. What kind of man was he?
Robert Peel is the first of the post-industrial revolution prime ministers. Although he came from a family which had large estates in the Midlands, the family fortune had been made in trade. His father and grandfather had huge calico printing factories in Lancashire, and they were a very wealthy family. But although, as I say, he was a landowner, that's where the family wealth came from. He was a new man in that respect, and could devote himself to politics as a professional politician. And he'd done that very successfully within the Tory party, virtually since he came down from university at Oxford. In the early 1800s, he was made a minister very young in his career and had risen fast through the ranks of the Tory party. On the basis also of his intellect, he was a very bright man. He'd been awarded the first double first degree at Oxford in mathematics and classics when he was a student. And he was regarded with some awe by most Tories. He, by the 1840s, as a party leader, was really the biggest figure in the Tory party. And that meant that he was the obvious leader of the party and bestrode the House of Commons. He was regarded as the most accomplished speaker, the most devastating debater. But he was a very chilly man. He was affectionate towards his family and his close friends, but he didn't suffer fools gladly. I think that's the best way of putting it. Daniel O'Connell, the leading Irish politician, famously referred to him having a smile like the brass plate on a coffin lid. And he was icy, particularly to those people he didn't rate. And he didn't rate an awful lot of the backbench Tories, who he thought were frivolous and amateurs in politics, who didn't pay attention to the economic and political arguments of the day. He was sort of contemptuous of them. He said that it was like a fox hunt, really. Leaders led and the hounds followed. And the hounds, in that case, were the Tory backbenchers. So there was respect for him, but very little admiration or affection.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
You can get a little twinge of this in the Brexit debate, actually. The fierceness of the arguments, the absolute refusal to bend and on both sides.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Now, when he when Peel began opposing the Cornels, he had some pretty unpleasant insults thrown his way, didn't he, by his by fellow Tories. I mean, can you provide some examples of the personal attacks that were levelled at him?
Yes, the Cornels were all part of the bigger free trade argument that Peel had bought into. He knew that the Cornels were a great sort of shibboleth for the landowners and agriculturalists of the Tory party, and so it would be much more politically difficult to abolish them, but that's what he clearly wanted to do. As part of the parcel of reducing and removing tariffs on all industrial goods coming into the country and being exported. So it was part of a larger economic theory, and it was something that he'd been working towards over a number of budgets. He also, although he had a Chancellor of the Exchequer, he tended to present the budgets of his administration in the 1840s himself. And they'd removed tariffs on hundreds and hundreds of items. And eventually, the object was to scale back and eventually, over a number of years, remove the corn laws so that that would free up corn imports. He knew he couldn't do it easily. But eventually he felt he had no choice because the reports coming in from Ireland showed that there was starvation beginning in Ireland, and that gave him a political excuse to say, well, this is an emergency, people are starving, we must get them cheaper food. Of course, the Tory backbenchers, who were sure that he wanted really to get rid of the Corn Laws once and for all, were deeply suspicious of Peel and his motives. And so when in the spring of 1846 he pushed for this measure to come as a means of relieving distress in Ireland, the Tory backbenchers were seething with disapproval and opposition, and they found their spokesman in a very strange person, really, for them, the young flamboyant novelist Benjamin Disraeli, not only a young, transparently ambitious politician on the make, impoverished, very flamboyant in his dress, very un-Tory-like in many of his mannerisms and attitude, and above all, even though he wasn't Jewish, he had the name Disraeli, and he was regarded with some suspicion by the Tories. But he had one great thing going for him, and that was his wit and his flamboyance in oratory and debate. And he deployed it ruthlessly against Peel, who frankly wasn't used to being challenged and laughed at, which is what Disraeli succeeded in doing against him.
Didn't he almost have Peel in tears a few times in Parliament?
Yeah, eventually he not quite broke down, but he was certainly very discomforted by the things that Disraeli was saying. Disraeli had actually applied when Peel became Prime Minister in 1841 for a job in government. He'd wanted one and he'd actually begged for one. And Peel knew this, but he turned him down because he was, in the Tory sense, rather suspicious and contemptuous of him and didn't think he was up to much. And so there was a strong element of revenge, which Peel recognised in Disraeli. There came a point in one of the debates when Peel said, in response to one of Disraeli's attacks, there was a time when you wanted to be in the government, essentially. And Disraeli shamelessly got up behind him and said, no, 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 I never applied for a job in your government. Now, Peel allegedly had the letter of application in his folder in front of him in the Commons that night. Whether he did or not, who knows? But he certainly knew all about that. And instead of deploying it against Disraeli, which would probably have destroyed Disraeli's political career once and for all, Peel disdained using it and refused to respond. And I think it probably aggravated the pro-Corn Law people more than a little that he was so disdainful to them. He repeatedly deployed political and economic arguments, and he really couldn't understand why they couldn't see it. Yeah. You know, I'm telling you these things. And eventually he got very emotional about it because he said at one point, why won't you do this when how much bloody flux and diarrhea and cholera will you accept from the Irish peasantry? How much do they how many of them have to die before you'll give in to this? Which was very strong stuff, deep in the Hansard record. And they said, you know, well, our peasants are much better off anyway. You know, they're fine with this. They support us all the way. And Peel just couldn't hit their emotional buttons. And they got harder and harder in their opposition, more and more frenzied. You can get a little twinge of this in the Brexit debate, actually. The fierceness of the arguments, the absolute refusal to bend and on both sides. And Peel got more and more despairing, and they got more and more vehement. The other leading opponent on the Tory benches was a man called Lord George Bentinck, who was a friend of Disraeli's, became a friend of Disraeli's. He was a hugely wealthy landowner in Nottinghamshire. And he actually accused Peel at one stage of effectively killing his relative, George Canning, who'd been briefly prime minister in the 1820s and died. Peel had refused to serve under him because at that stage he'd opposed Catholic emancipation, which George Canning was in favour of, and so had refused to stand in the government. And Canning had struggled to form a ministry. He had done so, but then he died. And Bentinck said, well, Peel was responsible for that. Peel was absolutely furious. He wanted to challenge him to a duel, which would have been a remarkable thing in the mid-19th century. And he had to be talked out of it by one of his friends. They walked up and down Whitehall in the early morning. You can imagine a hot June morning in 1846. There was a heat wave going on, so you can imagine what the smell was like coming off the Thames. Peel's house was on Whitehall, and they walked up and down outside as the early labourers went to work, the early clerks. Peel being argued out of fighting a duel with Bentinck, which would have been a disaster anyway. And he thought better of it, eventually went to bed, slept on it, got up later in the morning, and demanded an apology. And eventually Bentinck, with great ill grace, sort of backed down. But this was a measure of just how frenzied the whole thing was.
How did Peel go about revoking the Corn Laws? I mean, how did he get it through? Was it a close-run thing?
In the end, it wasn't a particularly close-run thing, because Lord John Russell, having announced his support for the repeal of the Corn Laws, whipped the Whig Party into line with the Peelites. But about two-thirds of the Tory backbenchers opposed it. So it got through with a large majority, and it got through the Lords with a large majority too, where they thought they might have trouble. But the leader of the Tories in the House of Lords was the Duke of Wellington, immensely respected, the victor of Waterloo, old soldier, and he made sure that the Lords fell into line. But there was a catch at the end. The same evening, there was an Irish security bill that was also going through the House at the same time. And it was to boost security for the forces in Ireland at the time of the famine. It's normally an utterly uncontroversial measure that everyone would accept. But in the circumstances, the Tory rebels sided with the Whigs, who opposed it, and that's what brought Peel down the same night as the Corn Laws were finally repealed.
So the Corn Law crisis caught up with Peel in the end. I mean, what happened to him eventually? What did it do to him on a personal level?
Well, he and his followers, the Peelites, about 60 or 70 of them, went into independent opposition. Lord John Russell formed a government and took power. The Peelites tended to support him on free trade measures, and eventually people like Gladstone, who'd been a follower of Peel, moved over, and the Liberal Party was born of Whigs and Peelites. Peel stayed in the Commons and spoke out against the government on various occasions, and then had a rather unfortunate accident in 1850, 4 years later. He was on the committee planning the Great Exhibition, which was to take place the next year. And he went to a meeting in Buckingham Palace with Prince Albert to discuss it, got back on his horse, which was a new horse he'd only recently bought, which had a somewhat skittish reputation. That wouldn't have bothered Peel, because like everyone else, he'd ridden for decades. But he was clip-clopping back down Constitution Hill to get home. And he saw two young ladies that he recognised and stopped to, they were riding as well on Rotten Row, I think. And he stopped to have a few words with them. And something scared his horse. And the horse bucked and threw him and then rolled on top of him. And it crushed him, basically. And he was carted back to his home. There was very little that surgeons could do in those days. And he died in considerable agony two or three days later. So he didn't have a long afterlife. But the outpouring of emotion when he died was very strong and considerable from the working classes, particularly of the industrial areas, who saw him as the saviour of their lives. He was the man who'd given them cheap bread. He was the man who'd stood up to the agricultural interest. And even to this day, you can go round the cities of the Midlands and the North and see statues of Sir Robert Peel, which were erected after his death by public subscription. So he was a very popular figure at the end.
Sure. And what would you say were the chief legacies of the Corn Law crisis?
Well, it split the Tory party. Some were never reconciled, people like Gladstone, people like Peel. Disraeli seized the leadership of the Tory party in the Commons. Most of the leadership was in the Lords, people like Lord Derby, considerable landed magnate in the north of England. Disraeli didn't really have landed estates. He borrowed money from Lord George Bentinck to buy his house outside High Wycombe. He rapidly abandoned any idea of returning to the Corn Laws. Within two or three years, he told the Tories that that game was up. And there was no chance of restoring the Corn Laws. So it was a brief cause for him, and it got him where he wanted to be, right in the heart of the leadership of the Tory party. But it took the Tory party until he himself became prime minister nearly 30 years later in 1874 to really get back into power. They'd had brief ministries in the 1860s, but really to form a majority government took them 30 years. And that's the chief legacy of the Tory split in 1846. The acceptance of free trade and being out of power, a lesson they hated learning, and it's the longest they've been out of power in the 300 years that there has been essentially a Tory party.
And finally, Stephen, why should we care about the Corn Law crisis today? I mean, does it have any echoes in the 21st century?
I think it does. Certainly, the argument over free trade, over protectionism of indigenous products, indigenous agriculture, has continued to be divisive within the Tory party particularly, and most clearly has echoes of even today in the Brexit argument. In fact, the foreigners who are coming over here telling us how to run ourselves, interfering with our free trade, telling us what to do. These are all things which were foreshadowed 180 years ago in the Corn Law crisis. There was a backbench MP for Cambridgeshire called Elliot York, who said if you repeal the Corn Laws, you might just as well call it the Foreign Serfs Assistance Bill, because you're just putting money in the pockets of foreign farmers. They'll dictate our prices. They'll dictate what we do. An argument which is strikingly similar to the sort of thing we heard during the Brexit debates over the last few years.
That was Stephen Bates. You can read Stephen's feature on the Corn Laws in the May issue of BBC History magazine, which is on sale now and also includes articles on medieval magic and the anarchy, as well as a special supplement to mark the 75th anniversary of VE Day. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Join us next on Sunday for another episode of our special Everything You Wanted to Know But Were Too Afraid to Ask series.